Hello, I'm Bruce Edwards, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In this program, the promise of private investment in sub-Saharan Africa.
I would say that foreign direct investments is going to explode. And I believe that this region is on the cusp of an economic revival.
With public debt on the rise in sub-Saharan Africa, boosting the private sector has become more important than ever. Ziyong Heng is a private investor for TLG Capital, an investment firm that focuses on equity opportunities in Africa. Heng says investors are missing out on great investment opportunities because of misperceptions of risk and the business environment. Heng joined a panel discussion on the topic during the 2018 IMF World Bank Spring Meetings.
We tend to look at deals that are smaller size. What I mean by that is we typically look at deals as $1 million all the way to even $20 to $25
million. So $20 to $25 million is considered a small business?
I would say substantially small compared to the grand scheme of things where you have larger cap companies like your oil and gas, infrastructure companies that goes beyond $100 million.
I see.
And when you have that, you typically focus only on three sectors: infrastructure, natural resources, and extractive industries.
And of course, there's a lot more than that in
Africa. There's a lot more in this. In fact, there are so much more interesting areas that you don't see it if you are subjected to a minimum size deal size, which we do not have. I mean, we do look at things at $1 million, but there are times where we even work with entrepreneurs for $500,000 for the first year to get them through the working capital initial phase. And then we ramp it up to $1 million and then $2 million the next year and so forth. So we do partnership capital rather than investment capital. And I think that's how we survive in Africa so far.
So explain to me how that works. What do you mean by
when
partnership?
I think it's more like, you see, when firms, like private equity firms, when they invest, I would say, I wouldn't generalize, but I would say the plain vanilla standard private equity firms, when they invest, they have already a predetermined exit horizon. They have determined their exit strategies and their duration bound.
So they have an idea of what kind of return they want to get from
yes.
their investment. And
how they want to exit. And because it is not because of that, but it's because how their fund is structured, how their strategy is. And for us, we are more structured like a permanent capital vehicle. And the reason why we do that is because we begin to realize that that's how you align your views with that of the entrepreneurs. You align your values with them. Rather than being an activist, you be like a suggestionist, I would say. So you put partnership capital rather than investment capital.
So it's a longer term.
It's a longer duration. So when you have a partner, when you're a permanent capital vehicle, you are able to maximize value for your shareholders and your portfolio companies without having this predetermined arbitrary divestment date.
I see.
So that's why I call it partnership capital rather than an investment capital. You want to learn about their companies, be their partner, rather than coming in as an investor slash activist and telling them, say, you have to do this, you have to do that, so that your company can grow exponentially. That gives me the right to exit in 5 years' time, you know?
So how much research do you do on these companies that you're interested in?
Yes.
Like, do you go on the ground and poke around and see who's doing what? And
of course.
Like, how much of that do you do?
I think I would say even 80%.
Really?
Of time you do as be on the ground. Because I could not emphasize anymore the understanding of local market peculiarities. It's very important than sitting at your desk, doing your due diligence, looking at data points. A better understanding of local market peculiarities could be negotiating with a supplier, learning how to do new business, getting new clients, or even navigating the bureaucratic government channels in certain countries. That all comes down to being on the ground, you being, you know. To put it in perspective, I was looking at that entrepreneur that does apparels and textiles. Back then, I was in Uganda. I was in Kampala visiting a factory, and he was showing me about the different places and asking one question. I was like, so where do you sell your apparels? And then I was pointing out to an upmarket shopping center. But then I realized that that's not where the main business is. The main business is in downtown Kampala, where the marketplaces, the people on the ground, people on the road selling it, peddling, you know, doing active buying and selling. That's where you actually see and sniff the rise of the African consumers there. And you wouldn't know that if you're not on the ground.
You mentioned data just a few minutes ago. This perception that doing business in Africa is risky, right? How much of that perception has to do with the lack of data? How much of a problem is the lack of data in Africa?
Oh, huge. But I would say that there are two parts in terms of perception. The first part is, yes, the lack of data is material in terms of the way people look at things, the way people view Africa. But that also comes down into investment opportunities. What do I mean by that? When you have US and UK, there are also investable opportunities, and how I call it is efficiency. In the US and UK, you look at efficiency, the efficiency of information, doing a due diligence on the management or the background check on a company, the country, the macro level, micro level. It's very easy. Whereas in Africa, the lack of data is a headache. But that also presents what I call an arbitrage opportunity. Hmm. This is what I mean by an information arbitrage. You know, arbitrage is something that you know that the other person do not know. And so you make money or you found an opportunity to leverage upon this, right? So in Africa, because of the inefficiency in information, the lack of inertia in people trying to understand beyond just what is given and publicly published, the inefficiency creates arbitrage opportunities for foreign investors like us, who are willing to spend the time, the effort, to go down there, to speak to people, to appreciate the local on-the-ground knowledge. That's one area of perception. But another side of perception is, like, I will call it investors' prejudice. Hmm. What do I mean by that? To give you a perspective, maybe I can use credit spread as an example. Credit spread in a bond just reflects investors' perception of risk for a particular asset. The credit spread has three layers, in my opinion. The first layer is what I call quantitative layer. You have your GDP per capita, you have your revenues, your debt to GDP, the amount of leverage you take up. That can be easily done on the desktop, looking at numbers. So you have the quantitative layer. The second layer that you have is what I call policies. You look at the ability of the government, the policies they're making. What are they doing? The structural reforms that you have, right? The ease of doing business index, the corruption index that you see that's published. And then you can always put it into your notes, your models, and then you say, okay, this is the amount of spread and risk that I'm willing to take. But the third layer is what I call the prejudice layer. I think the prejudice layer is what I mean is the perception that people have of when you talk about doing a deal in Nigeria, doing a deal in Sudan. There's this prejudice layer that people put. I will call it an exaggerated risk perception that people put on these companies.
The fear of investing in a company in Africa.
Exactly. So that's what I call that. And that's, you can see in the phenomenon right now, what you have is people over-investing, overlooking assets in developed markets versus under-allocation, under-investing in maybe even frontier economies. Mm. And this is what I like to term it as investor prejudice / biasness. Mm-hmm.
So on that same theme, trust, you mentioned that the companies that need the capital don't trust the people who have the capital.
A lot of these local entrepreneurs, they may want your capital, but they're not receptive to external feedback. You know, an external partner coming in to give them constructive feedback, constructive management advice in terms of how to build up their comparative advantage to make their company more efficient in a bigger picture.
So they may interpret it as being told what to do.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They often see this as more of an intimidation. They always are so used to doing what they do. And typically even look at family-run businesses there. They have great opportunities. I mean, Africa on its own, every single African country is there. There's loads of opportunities because they have a big market, huge population, high literacy, improving literacy rate, and a huge market that they can tap on. So opportunities are abound. But the ability to get better, to get efficient, that's where you need to be receptive to views. But at the same time, for us as foreign investors, we also need to how to align our views and values with them. We do not go in as if we are a big brother, but rather we go in as a partner, which comes down to my second point, which you just mentioned, the lack of trust. I think it's two ways. The lack of trust between people who wants capital and people who has capital. Because of this lack of trust there, you know, things do not move. There's always an inertia because you get stuck at the term sheet stage. And you're, you know, from a foreign investor perspective, you always want to heap in layers and layers of clauses because you think, what if the guy is going out there to cheat me? And the entrepreneur on their own was thinking, why are you doing this?
That means
you do not trust me.
Them,
exactly. So it actually is a negative feedback loop that you go along. And so there's, to a point of time, there needs to be a bit of trust there. So the best hedge to do business in Africa is what I call intimacy. The ability to be intimate.
The power of the handshake.
Exactly. The power of the handshake, the power to assimilate into the culture, to see them as a friend rather than just a counterparty that I want to invest and make my 25% IRR from this. But rather, I see this as a win-win situation. And so for us at TLG, when we have a permanent capital vehicle structure, we are not bounded for myself. I'm not bounded by a fund mandate that tells me I need to get out my money in five years. I need to achieve my return in X years. But rather, I have this flexible mandate that allows me to say, okay, let me work with you. And if we can do well, the company double, quadruple in size. I not only make my rate of return, but you as an entrepreneur will also be very satisfied that you just double the size of a company.
So you're in Washington to talk about encouraging investors to go to Africa, and it's sort of on a grand scale where there's international financial institutions like the World Bank and the IFC and the IMF. Everybody's in there trying to get investors to get more interested in Africa. Do you think that the world, the international community is focusing on the right things or are we not getting it? It seems that it's been tried before, right? And it hasn't been all that successful.
No, I think that the focus is in the right place. I think what the IFC, the World Bank are doing are commendable. But what I would like to preach is that investors, especially individual private investors, should see the region from a country perspective rather than have creating one narrative for the entire region. I think that is key here. So one country may have its own set of problems, but that does not translate into the similar set of problems in the other country. So there's always ways to do business there. There's always opportunities.
How many companies like yours are there out there right now? And how much appetite is there for this kind of investment outside of Africa? I mean, how much appetite is there from European, North American investors?
Well, I would say that foreign direct investments is going to explode. The explosion of more foreign direct investments is there. If it's going to happen anywhere around the world in the next couple of years, in my opinion, it's going to be in sub-Saharan Africa. Timing is key in everything we do. And I believe that this region is on the cusp of an economic revival. Penetration rate of private capital in this region is still considered low. And therefore, because it's low, a lot of assets tend to be overlooked. And because of that, competition is low. And that's why assets are now attractively priced. So if coming back to your point, penetration rate is still considered low here, right? So now is the right time for private capital to go in. And how do you want to do it here? It's actually by education. So a lot of investors wants to get in. They're interested. They understand the common narrative here about the rise of the African consumers, the rise of the middle class, how attractive Africa is.
The demographics.
The demographic. But they do not have the inertia in terms of navigating through this risk that forces them to say, you know what, let me put it on my back page, right? Because some foreign investors not just focus on sub-Saharan Africa. They have a wider mandate. And so if they're not going to look at sub-Saharan Africa, I'm going to look at Latin America, you know, Eastern Europe. So they have a selection of choices. So what we have got to do is to educate them, to understand them, to bring them in host, like what IMF is doing is very commendable, which is having this such of talks, these forums that improve the understanding of Africa, you know, bring different individuals who have skin in the game to speak about this and say, hey, You know, it's not as bad as it seems. It's all about a perception. There's a perception gap here between the people who has already been in the market and people who hasn't been.
So it seems, I mean, a lot of people are going to be happy to hear what you're saying. It's a fairly optimistic outlook on the future of investment in Africa.
Definitely. I think that for me, I can say that I'm very optimistic in terms of the potential that this region can provide. Why? Because from a macro perspective, political perspective, and even a social perspective, there's a lot of room for improvements, and there's an intent by not only the government, but individual level of trying to move towards a stage where they're ready to pursue global capital. But what is very important that I like to tell a lot of investors as well is that you got to be nimble, open-minded about how you invest in there. Being selective, nimble, and creative and open-minded is key to doing business in this region. But at the same time, the government, if they want to attract people and external capital like us, have to focus on political reforms, focus on policies where investors like us are comforted to know that our interests are being protected by the eyes of the law, policies that are in place so that we can just focus on concentrating and supporting the local community. I think that is key.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Ziyang Heng is a private investor for TLG Capital. He joined a panel discussion about attracting private investment in sub-Saharan Africa during the 2018 IMF World Bank Spring Meetings. You can watch the webcast of the seminar at imf.org. You can also find the latest regional economic outlook, which includes an entire chapter on private investment. And if you like this podcast, subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. And you can also now follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast.